Welcome to this DW Business special, asking what a year of war has done to Russia's economy. I'm Rob Watts in Berlin, and I'm pleased to say I am joined by Professor Jeffrey Sonnenfeld, whose research into the economic impact of war on Russia has made him something of a viral sensation over the past year, and we're pleased to have him back with us. Professor Sonnenfeld, it's been a heck of a year for you and, of course, for Ukraine and Russia.
Thanks so much. Yes, we've been quite busy, but we certainly don't have any of the sense of peril and suffering of the Ukraines. It is amazing the national character that has come to the surface as we have seen them overcome these political divides and character breakdowns of corruption and systems and things to unify a nation as we've rarely seen before. That selflessness is incredible. Of course, President Zelensky's leadership, but wherever you look in the nation, it's a remarkable sense of resolve. And yeah, we too have been on the sidelines and in a far more comfortable situation. We've had our team of 40 volunteers working pretty much 24/7, trying to keep up with constant changes on chronicling the exit of the unparalleled exit of 1,000+ major multinational companies from Russia in outrage over this attack on a peaceful sovereign nation and the civilian atrocities that are shameful by Russia, and then the economic impact on Russia.
Indeed. Well, we will talk about all of those countries that have left and the heck of an undertaking that you and your team have taken in trying to chart which companies are still in there and are not. But let's first get stuck into the state of the Russian economy right now. And a good place to start with that is looking at GDP. So what has been waging a war and being on the receiving end of international sanctions done to Russia's growth? Well, according to the government statistics agency in Russia, Rosstat, the economy contracted by just 2.1% last year. That is far better than predicted, with the World Bank back in April projecting an 11% loss for the year. Then looking ahead, the International Monetary Fund expects the Russian economy to grow this year, actually, albeit by just 0.3%. So, Professor Sonnenfeld, let's just tackle that. The fall in Russian GDP last year was nothing like some had predicted, and there might be a return to growth this year. So is Russia weathering the sanctions?
No. And as much as I love you, and you're the finest interviewer in the media, everything you said is untrue, and not because you are intending to promote anything that's less than the full truth. You're repeating credible sources who have been completely duped. You've heard it here first. The World Bank.
You're talking about the IMF and the World Bank here. So how have they got the wrong end of the stick?
The World Bank and the IMF information that you're innocently presenting is completely wrong, because it is directly, as you cited, off Rosstat. What do we know since the last time we spoke? Rosstat has had a change of leadership three times over. Why would that be? Three times over. Until they find apparatchiks that will do Putin's bidding. Since we last spoke, all of Russia's key information that to be a member of the World Bank and IMF, they are required to submit. They are not submitting. And the heads of the IMF and the World Bank won't tell you this, but they have no idea what Russia's actual imports and exports are. Why? Because by Q2 of 22, they stopped reporting it. We don't know about foreign direct investment. We don't know about any of the metrics that are required to be a participant in the IMF and the World Bank. All they're getting is invented numbers. So the reason Putin has survived economically are for only two reasons. One, lies. It's propaganda. He wakes up in the morning and picks a GDP number and puts it out there, and the IMF and the World Bank canonize that. They credential it without one. And we've gone in and met with the senior leaders of the IMF team twice. And we've actually talked to their economists, who happen to be largely Russian, by the way. And what do they know? They repeat exactly what Rosstat says. Well, it is literally, not virtually, it's literally asking Putin, how would you like us to make Russia look?
There are alternative sources as well on there. So there is research that's been done, for example, by...
No, there are no alternative sources that verify this. Every alternative source, wherever Russia's the buyer and we go to the seller, Russia's the seller, we go to the buyer, and all third parties confirm what we have, that the Russian economy is in a tailspin. There's nothing that supports them other than the fact that Aeroflot, the airline, is back up and running. Nothing else supports their false data. but they're pumping out false data, and it gets repeated in a circular fashion. The U.S. Humorist a century ago, Mark Twain, once said, a lie goes around the world and back before the truth can put on its shoes. So it gets recycled by the same media sources, false information. And that's what's happening here. There's no support. So, similarly,
Professor Sonnenfeld, what would you say is a more likely figure for Russia's growth during 2023 then? Because this 0.3% growth.
I can't invent a number just because Putin invents a number doesn't mean that I have the license to do it as well. We don't know. We do know that every key industrial sector is down. We know that the auto industry is down, not 10, 20, 30, 40, 80, 70. They're down 99%. 99%. We know the retail industry is down 65%. We get this from everybody who's selling into Russia or buying from Russia. We can see every sector. Sure, there's some smuggling that takes place. There's some electronics that get in through some third country, which is random smuggling. You can wait 3 months and pay a 60% premium and get a replacement screen for your iPhone. You can't run a major industrial sector based on intermittent supply at exorbitant inflated prices. So they're in trouble. Now, the workforce issue, which is another invented number on unemployment, what none of your viewers will have realized till this point, and none of my academic colleagues understood till recently, is that before the war, most of Russia's workforce was already working for the government or for state-owned enterprises. Now, it's even more so. Those laid-off IBM engineers, if they didn't flee to neighboring countries like Georgia or Uzbekistan, they're employed sweeping streets in Russia. So he's tried to absorb people by putting them on the public payroll. Well, how does he pay for that? Well, he's eating into some foreign currency reserves he's had, and that's dwindling. And also, he's cannibalizing. That's the second reason, other than the propaganda that he exists. He's harvesting. He's cannibalizing. We could send you the photographs of thousands of refrigerators being torn apart to harvest chips for use in military for weapons purposes. But industries their seed capital is being harvested. And same with paying people to stay employed. They're just taking them out of other businesses and trying to prop them up. It's not a sustainable economy. He's running deficits, and what the World Bank,
Professor
the IMF can't tell you is who is funding it. There's nobody that is buying Russian debt. So you can't run a deficit.
Professor Sonnenfeld, we can talk a bit more about how President Putin might be controlling the message on the Russian economy and exactly the sort of information that he is trying to put out there. And we can talk about that particularly this week, because President Putin gave a State of the Union speech a few days ago, coinciding with the anniversary of his invasion of Ukraine. In it, he did insist that the West had failed in its attempt to undermine the Russian economy. Let's just take a quick look at what he said.
The Russian economy turned out to be much stronger than the West had thought. Thanks to the joint work of the government, parliament, the Bank of Russia, the regional governments, and of course the business community and labor communities, we ensured the stability of the economic situation, protected citizens, saved jobs, prevented market shortages, and propped up the financial system.
Sonnenfeld, who is Vladimir Putin trying to convince there? Is it the Russian people? Does he have the Russian people on side already? Or is he trying to convince the global community that the sanctions haven't worked?
He's trying both audiences. You're exactly right. It's an excellent question. He wants to reassure his increasingly anxious population that has experiencing record unemployment and massive wartime deaths because of the fact that they did not have the three-day victory that they claimed they were going to have, and they're at best stalemated and losing ground in Ukraine, and the fact that they're losing. And he wants to wear down the resolve of all the allies, that it's a waiting game. He thinks it's a war of attrition that he can win by convincing the rest of the world that their efforts to stall him are not succeeding. They are succeeding. We know that he's losing $500 million a day on energy. People who say, oh, well, India and China are buying the oil that the West is no longer buying. We wish they'd buy more. Why? Because the price they're paying for the oil is so low. that Russia is losing money on every gallon right now. It costs Russia $45 a barrel to extract it from the ground, and another $10 or $12 to ship to India or China because it takes a month longer. So what it's costing.
It's an important issue. We're definitely going to go into the energy situation because we absolutely have to in a few minutes, Professor Sonnenfeld. But first, just a little bit back to what President Putin was saying there, and he was giving a shout out to the central bank of Russia and what it's done to manage to prop up the ruble. I mean, the ruble is stronger against the dollar than it was in the immediately before the war. But does that tell the full story?
No, it's another fake number. There is nobody that you could put on your show that could tell you they've traded the ruble. It's not an exchange traded currency. So you can't match it up against any currency if it's frozen. It's a number assigned by fiat. It's something we haven't seen anything like this in over a century. It's a fake number. There's not even a black market in rubles. So tell any financiers listening right now, we'll verify this for you. You can't get a value on a ruble because you can't exchange it. You can't trade it. Nobody wants to buy rubles. If your life or my life depended on it, we can't name a single non-Russian company that's going to conduct business that wants to conduct business in rubles. We don't know what the value is. It certainly has not been enhanced. The next question you could ask, which you haven't yet, is how come the stock market hasn't gone to zero? Well, once again, foreign holdings are frozen. You can't sell out any more than they've already sold. So it's fallen 60%, but not 100%, because the foreign assets can't be sold. The foreign owners of Russian assets can't sell their holdings. But the government has frozen the numbers. So any number that's thrown out there is a false number. And there's no source that you can give me that has a counter evidence. The evidence is only coming.
This is where your research comes in, isn't it? I mean, the lack of reliable numbers coming out of Russia. Then you and your team have managed to.
The U.S. Treasury Department, the Secretary of the Treasury herself, Janet Yellen, the U.S. Commerce Department, Secretary Gina Raimondo, and the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, have all said that we've changed the narrative on this, that even the U.S. government didn't realize that the international institutions were just recycling Putin's numbers. So now anywhere you go in the U.S. government, you'll see that they now know the Russian economy is failing, and they recognize that our numbers were right, and the IMF and the World Bank were just recycling propaganda from Russia, either unwittingly or knowingly.
Okay. Professor Sonnenfeld, stay with us. I just want to talk a bit about the research that you and your team at Yale School of Management have been doing, keeping track of which companies have pulled out of Russia. So they compiled a list. There's more than 1,400 companies on that list. And on that list are over 1,000 companies who have in some way curtailed their operations in the country beyond just what's demanded of them by sanctions. That includes brands like McDonald's, Starbucks, and others who you can see on the screen now who have exited Russia completely. Then there are also the companies who have scaled back their presences in Russia. Among them are Volkswagen and Sony. Google owner Alphabet is also dialing down its operations in Russia. And Professor Sonnenfeld's Yale team have also tracked over 240 countries who are, as they put it, digging in and maintaining full operations in Russia. Among them, Germany's Siemens Healthineers, and a few others you can see there, Air China, but over 240 of them. So, Professor Sonnenfeld, generating and maintaining that list must have been an enormous undertaking for you and your team. Has the existence of the list itself been enough to influence the decisions of some of those companies?
Yes, thanks for asking. There was a U.S. Supreme Court justice named Louis Brandeis who, around 80 years ago, said that sunlight is the best antiseptic. And as we got into this, because the early movers that pulled out on February 24th of last year told us they were most upset that the media and academics, my line of work and your line of work, were confusing the good guys with the fakers, the people who were bold movers versus those who were issuing platitudes, just saying atmospherics, oh, our hearts and minds are with the Ukrainian people. Here's $1.50 to go buy yourself a third of a cup of coffee. That they weren't doing anything. So we created a grading system of A, B, C, D, and F. And that grading system is calibrated every night. We go through the companies and evaluate them. And looking at the 1,400 major companies, over 1,000 of them have completely pulled out as either A's and B's. And that's been quite powerful. But initially, most of them were G's and F's. But as they right. had the spotlight of public scrutiny on them through customer feedback, investor feedback, employee feedback, there's been a mass exodus, six times that of the one in South Africa in 1988.
And of those Fs, as they're called in your study, basically the ones who are digging in, who are maintaining their operations as if, you know, the war wasn't basically happening, of them, 240 whatever of them that there are, would you expect to see any of them change their stance? I mean, we're already a year into the war now. Are those people going to are those companies going to continue to dig in?
A great question, because there were some that were digging in. The U.S. paper company, International Paper, was initially denying that they had an active state, and it turns out they had the controlling stake in the large paper maker, and they did ultimately exit. They even had their own management team, was half of that company's management team. They've all exited. And similarly, the U.S. company Koch Industries, K-O-C-H, was stubbornly staying in there. They too did now eventually pull out, and they've gone from F to A, which is a pretty remarkable move. So we've seen some move positively that way. We have, I'm sorry to say, seen a few companies move the other way too, and they're not happy with us. We've just now, you're the first to know this, just downgraded Carlsberg Breweries, which had announced they were pulling out. And in fact, never completed a sale, but it also didn't shut down their operations. And they continue to harvest their revenues and to fuel Putin's war machine, despite the platitudes that they issued. And we're frankly disappointed with Heineken, that is saying they're putting their profits in a reserve escrow account in Russia, but they're still operating there and they haven't found a buyer, unlike AB InBev, which just completely shut down and shuttered their operations. So, we're seeing there's been a movement, but the mass stampede was really in March and April, and now we see trickling movement, most of it going towards more companies pulling out.
Yeah, we did hear from Heineken earlier this week saying that they hadn't been able to find a buyer, and they now expect to sell their business at a loss if they do so. But is it the case that, well, they should be accepting a loss?
They should not only be accepting a loss, they should accept a complete write-down, and they won't cost them a penny. We have, and we put this research out in SSRN, the Social Science Research Network scholarly journals, also in the Washington Post and elsewhere. We've actually shown, naming the companies, but also showing the quantitative research of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of companies that pulled out completely. It actually benefited them against those 400 companies that stayed in. It hurt them, that it's reducing operational risk, reducing financial risk, reducing reputational risk, that it is actually, there's no gap between the interests of the shareholders and the interests of other stakeholders and the character of the firm. Doing, and this is at least one case where doing the right thing is rewarded financially. Doing good and doing well are not antithetical to each other. And it's surprising that Heineken, of all companies, which I used to use as a good example, didn't recognize that far earlier. For example, Royal Dutch Shell or BP, or Exxon, they shut down completely and immediately, and BP wrote down $9 billion right away. And what happened? They're rewarded enormously, almost 2.5 times over in the financial markets. So it turned out not costing them anything. You don't look at an investment in terms of what it costs. You take a look at what the return is, and the return dwarfs whatever they invested in their corporate character and their reputation. It's hard to do business in Russia right now. It's not a smart place to be. They have trouble paying people. They have trouble getting parts. They have trouble getting paid, let alone the cost of their corporate character. Places like Heineken or Unilever or Philips, it's bewildering that they're still there.
Okay, Professor Sonnenfeld, I just want to move on to something that you raised a little earlier on, and that is the fact that, you know, a major source of income for Russia's war machine is its sales of oil to the rest of the world. However, the EU and G7 have sought to limit that by capping the price that it's willing to pay for a barrel of Russian oil. Nevertheless, Russia still managed to export 8.2 million barrels of oil per day to world markets in January. That's down 160,000 thereabouts on pre-war levels. Asian markets are making up for a drop in uptake from the European Union, and I think Professor Sonnenfeld is going to challenge that in a moment. However, Moscow's oil revenues are definitely down, according to the International Energy Agency. It says that Russia made 36% less in the first month of 2023 compared to a year earlier. So let's speak to Professor Sonnenfeld on that. Has the West failed to hit Russia where it really hurts in its energy exports?
If there's anything that's been more effective than Kyiv defending itself, it has been the full frontal assault on Russia's energy business. Russia has become an economic afterthought. Russia is in no way an economic superpower in the world. Their economy, people used to say, is smaller than Italy. It's, of course, smaller than Chile now. And that's not to disparage the character of Italy or Chile. They just don't go around with Putin's swagger suggesting that there's some big, tough neighborhood bully. Why, in fact, Russia is two-thirds of its economy was coming from the energy business. We now know that nobody needs Russia's gas. Europe, 86% of the EU's gas was coming this time last year when we spoken, 86% was coming from Europe, from Russia. Now it's less than 7%, and it could go to zero and be inconsequential.
Is that a permanent change as well? Can Russia ever regain the EU as a major market for its oil and gas?
No. If you talk to the Baltic nations, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, who never fell for what Germany and others fell for, a Russian dependence, they'll say you should never have counted on looking at Nord Stream 1 or the promise of Nord Stream 2, and now I think Germany recognizes. In fact, what Germany did, which is another one of the miracles of the last year, is thanks to Germany, they have built 6 mega conversion plants and terminals to receive liquefied natural gas. Most energy analysts, either by their lack of information or their unwillingness to tell it on TV and in media circles, talking their own book. There was a hysteria late last spring driving up oil and gas prices wrongly. Is in fact liquefied natural gas, which has only been commercialized since 2015, 2016. It's a century old technology, but only became a major successful industry recently in the last 8 years or so, is that it's not figured into most of the analysts' equations, is that's turned out to be an enormous source of energy. It can be shipped. So now Norway and the US provide individually more than Russia did at its peak. And now Algeria and others are also adding to the equation. There are 12 other nations with very competitively priced LNG. LNG's price has fallen around 70% in the period of time this last year. So it's becoming more and more affordable. And the LNG gets converted thanks to Germany and some Iberian Peninsula conversion plants that pre-existed. But these massive, large ones that Germany built it so fast, you would have thought they were Chinese companies that built it. And who could imagine they could build something this fast? And now that gets converted from the form that it travels in, shipped as solid, basically as liquid, back into vapor form to go through pipelines throughout Europe. All Putin has is vapor form gas, is natural gas. When he, with his bravado, says we're just going to pivot and sell it to India and China, he can't. Why? Because he doesn't have the network of pipes. Again, the IMF, the World Bank, and most economists at major universities missed that. They didn't realize that Asia needs the network of pipelines from Russia that they don't have. It'll take them 6 years to build it, and there hasn't been one trench dug to begin building it, because they're not going to try. They couldn't do it in 6 years. So it's a big problem. Most of Russia's gas goes nowhere. In terms of Russia's oil, we would like India and China to buy more of it. It's so cheap. The G7, the UK, the EU, the US have all encouraged a $60 price cap, because that's where Russia is at, basically just above break even. Right now, Russia is losing on every barrel that they produce. It cost them $45, $46 a barrel to extract. It costed Saudis only $22, and most other OPEC nations only $20, $25 a barrel. Russia, it's so inefficient, so antiquated in their technology, that it cost them way more to pull it out of the ground. But then you have to add on to that another $10 or $12 in shipment to go the extra month that it takes to go to India or China. by barge.
Sorry to interrupt you, but it's to what you're saying here, and what I want you to just want to ask you to do here is sort of look into your crystal ball here, because you're talking about how Russia is going to, you know, go about making its money in the time to come. We first spoke to you maybe 10 months ago, and everything is so very different. I mean, the European energy sector is unrecognizable from where it was back then. Over the next 12 months, the next year, if the war continues, what do we need to keep an eye out for when it comes to the Russian economy?
We're going to see increased numbers of idled workers on the streets. We had, even in April, we had, as an economic sign, we had the mayor of Moscow, until he was silenced, admitting by April, TASS, of all things, reported this, hundreds of thousands of idled workers were in the streets with nothing to do. We're going to see that increase equally dramatically. It's a conservative estimate that 3 million highly sophisticated Russians have fled the country. We know that this is not an exaggerated number, because TASS itself, again by April, had already reported 700,000 have left. Well, where have they gone? They've gone to Georgia, Moldavia, and neighboring nations. But I just had a meeting with the ambassador to the U.S. from Uzbekistan, and they have almost 500,000 people from Russia. Sophisticated IT professionals have fled Russia for Uzbekistan, and the Tashkent Industrial Park has been soaring. So we're seeing not just no capital go into Russia, and there's nothing that Russia sells to the world marketplace, nothing other than raw materials. They don't have any finished goods. The only value-added product that they bring to the world is cyber terrorism that I don't think anybody wants to purchase. All they had was food, fuel, and metals. We now have alternative sources for all those commodities. They were like a colony in a mercantile system, and they're becoming perhaps a vassal state to China. And what we're seeing, despite the headlines with China right now, we're seeing that China doesn't mind tapping Russia for its resources, but they too realize they don't need Putin. Nobody in the world needs Russia, but it's fine if China and India use Russia for sourcing and keep global market prices down a bit. But Russia is making no money on anything they sell. And Russia and India, which of course are not signatories to the price caps, they're benefiting from them. They ride the coattails of them because they have no interest in paying more to Putin either. So they're paying the same prices as the signatories of the price caps. And frankly, in the eyes of the West, it's too low. We would like Putin to make a little bit more money so he still keeps producing. But if he's losing $1 to $2 a barrel right now, there's no incentive for him to produce oil at all. That's a problem. They're so inefficient.
Okay, Professor Jeffrey Seinbaumwald from Yale School of Management, thank you so much for joining us again for another DW Business Special. It's always great to have you on, and I hope we'll get to speak to you again at some point, and we'll see whether or not any of your predictions for the next year come to fruition. Thanks a lot to you who've been watching. It's been great to have you along with us. If you have enjoyed this, there's plenty more from the DW Business team here on the DW News YouTube channel. Make sure you do check it out, and maybe I'll see you over there.